Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that we got going on over there. The For You Radio Podcast. It's a podcast pulled from an actual radio show that 1517 underwrites. It's got Craig D'Onofrio on it, who is a friend of mine, friend of Chad's. He does good work, and he thinks that maybe Christ for You is something that you would be interested in hearing about. Go check that out over there. Also, I think it's season 3 of Family Style Theology with Cindy Koch has now dropped. So you can go check that out. If you're looking for something to do with your kids, that's what it is. It's Cindy doing theology with her children. So if you're a parent and you want to see what that looks like, hear what that looks like, you can check out that podcast. They're all over there at 1517.org/podcast. Also, if you're interested in hanging out with me and Chad and Jared C. Wilson and Scott Keith and Stephen Paulson and Loso and Delwyn Campbell and Eric Sorensen and Lisa Fitzpatrick, and their list goes on and on and on and on and on. You can come out to Here We Still Stand in October out there in San Diego. Come hang out, hear all the talks, come eat all the food, come do all the fellowshipping. It's going to be great. There's a few tickets left, and so we would like you as a podcast listener to have those tickets. And as few as those tickets that are left, there's even fewer hotel rooms left. So if you haven't got your hotel room reserved yet, our block is almost full. So you need to get over there and do that. You can get all the information over at herewestillstand.org. You can register for the conference if you haven't done that. If you have registered for the conference but you haven't reserved your hotel room, you can do that. We'd love to hang out with you. And if you haven't signed up yet, I mean, we want the 40-minute crew there. So you can get that. You can get that discount by entering the promo code PNET19. PNET19, like Podcast Network 19. Enter that in the promo box and you get $25 off each and every ticket you buy. So get that done. Chad, what's going on, man? Here we are in Deuteronomy 12.
Here we are. Yes, sir. I think I met anyway to get us into 12 last time, but we were slightly delayed, so.
Well, I'm the one running this show, Chad. You have your goals, but you know.
You got yours. If we cover a chapter, I'm pretty impressed with us.
I am too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we're at. We pretty much wrapped up 11 last time, so we're, I did mention last time that beginning with chapter 12, we're really in the heart of Deuteronomy as far as like content wise 12 through 26 is the legal core, if you will, of Deuteronomy. So it was a good place to stop and then a good place to start, so that we're at a good jumping off point to get into this main section. So 12 is really all about worship in one way or another, and connected with worship with the first commandment. And then we'll talk about various aspects of that in chapter 12. And then chapter 13, which actually came up in the Q&A that we had the other night in the Facebook Live for the 1517 Academy class, Christ in the Old Testament. One of the guys, my buddy down in Australia, I believe it was, asked me about chapter 13. So we had a little foray into that in the Facebook Live. We'll get to that either today or next time. But anyway, 12 is about worship. 13 is about who you listen to with regard to speaking the words of God. And we'll hear about false prophets and temptations to idolatry when we get into chapter 13. So we start out here with 12, and I'll read these first three or four verses. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. And you shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their asherim with fire. And you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods, and you shall obliterate their name from that place. You shall not act like this toward the Lord your God. It seemed to be pretty black and white there. not on the gray area. When the Israelites go into the Promised Land, one of their chief tasks is to make sure that every single place of worship which was used by the Canaanites for their detestable worship, and we'll hear more about that later in the chapter, is to be like bulldozed down. There is to be no, in other words, it's not going to be like the Israelites who can go in and be like, hey, this is a pretty nice place. You know, Canaanites used it to worship Baal, and they sacrificed their children here, and they practiced all their other abominations, but we can just take it over rather than building something of our own. God says, nope, it's not the way it's going to be. If there's a wooden pole there, one of these Asherah poles, who was the popular goddess of the day, well, I want you to burn it. If there's an altar there that was used to sacrifice to Baal, I want you to tear it down. If there's a temple there, I want you to bulldoze it. So he wants him to utterly destroy all these places of false worship when they enter the land.
Yeah, this is really interesting, actually. I mean, obviously God is not interested in them. God is very much opposed to them worshiping false gods, of course. I mean, this is the first and great commandment not to do that. But here, he's not talking about that so much as he's talking about them not adopting worship in the forms that these people are worshiping. So what he also doesn't want, as much as he doesn't want them worshiping these gods, he's taking that as a given here. We've been through this a number of times. I don't want you worshiping these gods, but I don't want you worshiping me like these people worship these gods. I don't even want you worshiping me in the places that these people worship those gods. And so this tells you that God is not only concerned that you only worship him, the one true God, but that the way that you worship him is important, which tells us that this idea that, I mean, you just worship God any way you want, it's fine. God doesn't really think that's fine. Some other religion may worship their God a certain way, so we could go baptize that and we'll just do that. He's not interested in that. And I honestly think that, and we'll get into some of this explanation, but I think that part of this is that the way that God prescribes that he be worshipped has so much foreshadowing and is pointing towards Christ and the cross that he is sort of protecting that imagery and that symbolism. He doesn't want these outside things getting in there because, we went over this a bunch of times, especially in Leviticus, but the way that God prescribes worship to be done, and we've showed over and over again how this points to Christ and how Christ fulfills all this stuff, right? So he didn't want these outside things coming in and disrupting the foreshadow and the symbolism that he's setting up.
Yeah, absolutely. If you ever wonder exactly why God goes into such incredible detail in Leviticus and in Exodus with regard to exactly how he wants things to be built and placed and what he wants there, what he wants done with all the various objects in worship. I mean, if it seems as if God is just being just a little bit OCD about all this, well, keep in mind the real reason behind that, and that every single aspect of Old Testament worship was a foreshadowing of Christ. And so it's really in order to protect the gospel, in order to make sure that there's going to be a clear confession about who Christ is and his work for us, that God is so careful about spelling out all of these. It's all of these details. It's not like God is just like, he's not just like a stickler for details just to be that way. He's that way for a greater purpose, because he wants all of this to clearly and gracefully point forward to what he actually is designed all of it to do, to be yes, for the Israelites then and there, but also to extend beyond itself to point to the work of Christ who is to come.
You see some of this go down, when he talks to the Canaanite woman, and she's like, you know, hey, we're worshiping over on this mountain, and then, you know, the Jews say to go worship on that mountain and this kind of thing. And first Jesus acknowledges that she's wrong in the way that she's understanding like how worship should be. But then he says, the day is coming when neither of these things are going to matter. And the day is coming that a lot of the stuff that God says, like, hey, worship me this way, isn't going to matter. But it's not until Christ that doesn't matter. Until Christ, it matters a lot because it's pointing towards him.
Yeah, it's always amazed me that the Samaritan woman in John 4, she actually believes in the Messiah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that we just sort of skim over sometimes, unless we really know exactly, well, what is Samaria and who are the Samaritans? Well, the Samaritans were kind of religious half-breeds, if you will. I mean, they were a mixture of non-Jewish peoples who settled on the on Israelite soil and decided to want to make their own temple on Mount Gerizim instead of Jerusalem. In fact, they are still Samaritans. I mean, the Samaritan religion still exists. They have their own scriptures, which is only the Pentateuch. And there are several discrepancies between their Samaritan Pentateuch and the Pentateuch that we have. But I mean, they still continue on to this day. There's not very many of them. But what they represent is what the Samaritan woman believed in. But the amazing thing is that actually she confessed faith in the Messiah. Even though she wasn't a Jew, she still believed that the Anointed One was to come. And of course, little did she know at the beginning that she was actually standing face to face with him. But that's the point of at the end of that conversation that Jesus has with her is that, well, okay, yes, Jerusalem is the true place of worship now. But a time is coming when that true place of worship is going to be in spirit and in truth, and that really the place of worship is going to change from a place to a person. So it's in the Messiah, in me, in other words, Christ says, that a true worship is to take place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is where you move from the tabernacle and the temple to the God who tabernacled in flesh, right?
Yeah,
and this is where everything moves to, yeah. But until then, you really need that tabernacle and such things to point forward.
Yeah, that's a good segue into the next section, because that ends up being the key. If there is like a key theme in Deuteronomy 12, it's that when the Israelites worship, they can't simply, like when they have their official worship, when they have sacrifices, when they have their sacred meals, that this isn't going to take place just willy-nilly wherever they want it to, like, oh, there's a cool place, let's do it there. No, God says, I'm going to choose a place, and I'm going to put my name there. We'll get back to that in just a minute, the name theology. And it's only there, precisely there, that I want you to worship. So this fits in with that introductory section that we saw. So first of all, God says, I want you to obliterate every worship site of the peoples that you are going to dispossess. Completely do away with those, and you're not going to worship at those places because of the reasons we've already discussed. So where are you going to worship? Well, you're not going to worship just any old place you want to. Just choose a high hill and worship there. No, you're going to worship at that place, which I shall choose to put my name there. But this has a couple of different meanings. Right now, and for the foreseeable future, up until really the time of King Solomon, that place is going to be wherever the tabernacle is located. And the tabernacle, being a portable dwelling, being a tent, it was moved around to various places. It wasn't like moved all the time in the land of Israel, but it did occupy several different places in the land of Israel before it was moved close to Jerusalem. So wherever it happened to be, wherever it was set up, that was the place where God had put his name, because that's the place where the tabernacle was located. Well, eventually, of course, the tabernacle was replaced by a permanent dwelling when Solomon built the temple, and then that became the place where God put his name. And so it was to Jerusalem that the Israelites would go to worship. But the point was that name place was wherever God's dwelling was, whether it was a tabernacle or whether it was later the temple. That was the only place where one could offer sacrifices. That was the only place where the tithes were to be brought, the only place where sacred meals were to be offered. So again, we see the specificity that God has with regard to where his people dwell. And this again gets right back to Christology. It's the same with us. We can't just worship anyone that we want to. We worship one person, Christ, because he is the tabernacle in flesh. He is the temple. His body is the temple of God. So all of our worship, therefore, is directed through him to the Father and not through anyone else. Now, back to the name. I want to talk about that for just a minute because I think this is significant. This isn't always a language that we hear, because sometimes God will talk about, like, he puts himself in the tabernacle, or he himself dwells there, or sometimes you'll hear that like his glory dwells there. But a major theme that we have, not just in this chapter in Deuteronomy, but actually throughout Deuteronomy, as well as in some of the passages in Kings, is this idea that God puts his name there. So look at verse 5. Verse 5 says, "You shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes to establish," literally in the Hebrew, to set or to place his name there for his dwelling, "and there you shall come." Now, the reason I point this out is because this becomes very significant later on. There's this idea, let me back up. So when you hear the name of God, there's a couple of different ways that you can view that. Sometimes it's just basically, it's just synonymous with talking about God does this or the name of the God does this. But there are also cases where there seems to be almost, the name almost has not an independent, but some sort of distinct identity from God himself. Like God is in heaven and he puts his name in the tabernacle. So there's this idea of the name almost being what theologians would call a hypostasis, like almost has this distinct personhood. And I think this gets right back to what we've been talking about before, this idea that God has, that there is this distinction within God clearly in the Old Testament, where, for instance, God will send his angel, his messenger, or he will appear in his glory, or he will send or establish or put his name there. So there is this complex monotheism that you see in the Old Testament, which becomes clearer and clearer, which we confess to be the Trinity, where there is this distinction in God between the three persons. That's not the way the Old Testament talks about it, but what the Old Testament talks about it are in these ways in which God is distinguished within himself, where you have, for instance, in Psalm 110, verse 1, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand." Well, in Trinitarian language, we would say the Father said to his Son, sit at my right hand. But in the Old Testament, it's phrased differently. Similarly here, we would say, for instance, that the Father placed his Son in the tabernacle. But the way the Old Testament says it is that the Lord put his name in the tabernacle. Or we would say the Father sent his Son as the messenger to the patriarchs. But the way the Old Testament says it is Yahweh sent his angel, his Malach, his messenger, to speak to the patriarchs. The reason I point this out, I think this is a good way that we as Christians who confess the Trinity can think about the Trinity in its specific Old Testament terminology. That yes, God, it's not like God evolved into a Trinity. This God didn't change. This is who he's always been, but the way that God has revealed himself from Old Testament to New Testament has changed according to the terminology and the clarity with which he reveals himself as the Trinity. I don't know, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think that it's not exactly like this, but once you sort of have the Old Testament decoder ring, like you start to see the Trinity everywhere. I mean, so you have, I mean, all the way back, obviously you have the "let us make man in our image." You have that sort of thing, right? Which, you know, I mean, that's plural, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you have
right.
God speaking to himself. But even in creation, you know, you have it just goes down to, you know, the first article of the creed, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth." So we're like, okay, so God creates things. He creates things through the Word, which is Christ. So the Word, his Word goes forth. And you have the Spirit, you know, hovering over the water. Like, and so, I mean, you have all of it, right? I mean, the very beginning of the Bible, you have these hints at the Trinity. And then throughout the rest of Scripture, you see God and you see the angel of the Lord, which, you know, we've said over and over again, you have Christ there. And then we haven't got into some of these passages, but once we get into some other narratives, you're going to see the Spirit of God in certain stories in the Old Testament. The Spirit of God does stuff. And it doesn't even like use coded language. It'll say the Spirit of God like came upon so-and-so and they did this thing. Even David say, you know, in Psalm 51, say, crying out to God to not take his spirit from him, you know, this kind of thing. So, yeah, you have the Trinity everywhere.
Yeah, I think once you understand who God is, and most Christians do so from the New Testament, once they begin to read back through the Old Testament, all of a sudden, all of this becomes clear.
Yeah.
It's really no different than what we have made explicit in the Gospel of John several times. I say several, at least two or three different times. John says explicitly that, like, when such and such happened, the disciples didn't get it. But then later, when they remembered, then they got it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, when so they're the disciples have been with Jesus this whole time, and they still really, you know, they're still kind of dense. You know, things just aren't really clicking with them. But then after his resurrection and ascension and Pentecost, they start going back over everything that he did and that he said, and they're like, oh, yeah, it's kind of like it's an Emmaus Road kind of epiphany. Well, I think it's – well, that happened with the disciples when they went back over the life of Jesus, and that really happens with us as we go over the Old Testament. We have these Emmaus Road epiphanies, which, well, you know, we've read this story, but until we see it in light of Christ and who God is, then we really don't understand it. But once we have that decoder ring, as you put it, then, yeah, all of a sudden the scriptures really open up, and we're able to see – we're not reading into them what isn't there. We're not engaging in what is sometimes called eisegesis, like reading something into that that's not already present. Rather, we're reading out the fullness that God has put in these scriptures, because even when God was inspiring these earlier scriptures, he was doing so in such a way that the fullness that is there would not be made clear, would not be manifest until the end of all things, when the Messiah comes and we have that clarity that we need now to understand the scriptures.
Yeah, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think that the disciples are, I think the disciples are hilarious, because I think that they say yes, that they understand stuff to not appear stupid when they totally don't understand stuff, because there are times where Jesus will actually ask them, do you understand everything I've said? And they're like, yep. And it becomes very clear, like in the next chapter, that they don't understand anything that he said.
Yeah. My favorite story is when they're in the boat, and Jesus warns them about the leaven, the scribes and the Pharisees. And they're like talking to each other like, oh, man, it's because we didn't bring any bread.
Yeah.
And you could just – you could almost see Jesus in the back of the boat just doing a face palm like, ugh, I'm not talking about bread, guys.
Yeah, there's a great meme out there where it says, this is where Christianity went sideways. It has the disciples being like, what did he say? And then it says, it has Peter, and he says, he said that we are to be salty to the whole world.
That's great. I haven't seen that one. That is worth everything. It's sideways. Yeah. A little misunderstanding.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I mean, because the disciples are human just like we are. And how many times have we, you know, we don't want to appear stupid. We don't feel like, you know, especially if it seems like everybody else gets it. So we're like, yeah, yeah, we understand, sure.
Yeah. Are you able to drink from the cup that I have to drink? Totally.
Oh, yeah.
Totally, no, I'll drink. I could totally drink that.
Little do they know. Yeah, so there is this distinction within God. And I think we see a hint of it here where God puts his name in certain places. So God is there, and yet he puts his name, the God of heaven puts his name in the tabernacle. This is sort of a winking sort of way to suggest that God puts his son in the tabernacle. And I was thinking about the significance of the name too, that we have discussed this before, but I don't think that we really get how significant it is that we know the name of God, because names are easy for us, right? We know each other's names. We know the names of famous people. And so to know somebody's name really doesn't strike us as that significant. But biblically speaking, when you have access to someone's name, especially to the name of a God, you have access to them in a very intimate, personal sort of way. So in biblical thinking, the name is intimately connected with the nature of a thing. Thus, to have access to the name is to have this link to the nature of something. So to have the name of God, to have access to the name of God, is to have that access to his very nature. So it's a very intimate kind of knowledge. Now, this is by far a weak analogy, but it sort of gets to this idea of what it means to have access. So just imagine, you know, whoever you really look up to, maybe you're a fan of some star, and You can't, I mean, of course, you know their name, but you don't have any access to them. Well, just imagine if you had their cell phone number and you could contact them. I mean, you have sort of a more intimate, direct connection to them. Well, in a, I say it's a weak analogy, but that kind of gets to this idea that we have this connection to God by means of his name so that we can access him in a way that wouldn't be possible otherwise. So that's what it means when we talk about the significance of the name. When we have the name, we can call upon him. He claims us as his own. He puts his name upon us. So there's this very close relationship that established between God and his people by him giving them access to his name. Going through the rest of the chapter here, we have the significance of only going to that certain place that God chooses. And we also have this emphasis that we've seen, especially in Leviticus 17, about making sure that the blood is dealt with in the proper sort of way. So verse 16 echoes Leviticus 17, where it talks about the life is in the blood, because Deuteronomy 12, 16 says that if you're in your city and you want to have meat, well, you can do that. You can slaughter like a deer or a gazelle or something like that. Verse 16 says, only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. So this is echoing what we have heard many other times, but especially in Leviticus, that the life is in the blood. And so because of that, the Israelites are forbidden to eat blood, to eat meat that has not been drained of its blood, because that is the equivalent of them consuming the life. And God has said that because the life is in the blood, he's given it to them on the altar. So the blood, which is suffused with life, which is connected with life itself, is to be poured out either on the ground or in the case of like non-sacred kinds of meals with meat. But in the case of sacrificial meals in which the meat is consumed, it is to be poured out on the altar. But either way, the blood is not to be consumed because the blood has the very life essence of the animal within it.
You're not to consume the blood, of course, until Jesus says, take and drink, this is my blood. I love the great reversal of you're not allowed to drink the blood because the life is in the blood. And then Jesus comes along and says, here's my blood, drink it, the life is in the blood.
Yeah, yeah. If there's like, if I could have a snapshot of any moment in the ministry of Jesus, I think I would like to have that one, because I'd love to see the looks on the disciples' face. Yeah. I really don't think anything in the Old Testament prepared them for that kind of reversal. I mean, that's a...
Oh, you see this explicitly in John 6, that this is just a bridge way too far.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I think if I would agree that I would either see that, or I'd love to see the John 6 thing go down and just see how just confused everyone was. Like, no, yeah. No chance this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of those very explicit reversals that you have, because we have multiple times in the Old Testament that, I mean, if there's one thing regarding blood that is absolutely clear, you never drink it. Absolutely never. And then Jesus, not only, he doesn't like permit, it's an imperative. He says, here, drink my blood. So this is the reversal of the Old Testament. This is what is radically new about the new covenant. At the institution of the Old Covenant, blood was sprinkled on the people. But that happened multiple times. At the ordination of priests, blood was placed in their bodies, their ear and their thumb and their toe. So the placing of blood on the outside of the body was an Old Testament thing. But the placing of blood inside the body was never to happen until Christ comes and changes all that, because he wants to put his life within us. And to do that, he bids us drink from his cup.
Yeah, I mean, so you have this whole don't drink the blood as a prohibition, because God's intention is for you actually to drink the blood of life. It just hasn't arrived yet. That's not the blood that's for you. That blood is coming.
It's, I guess the closest analogy we can come up with is the prohibition in the commandments against making an image of God, right? You know, not to make any image of God whatsoever in the Old Testament. That's another thing which is crystal clear. No image of God, period. And then you get to the New Testament, and at the incarnation, Jesus is the image of God. So God has given us his own image and in human flesh and blood. So likewise, in the Old Testament, it's crystal clear, no drinking of blood. And yet, when Christ comes, he says, drink my blood. So there are clear reversals that happen within the Old Testament in which you have prohibitions, which are themselves almost prophecies, because what is prohibited is at the same time for looking forward to that which will be given when the Messiah comes and changes things. I think the only other thing I want to point out, we really covered the rest of the chapter. Everything that's discussed there has to do with offerings and where you offer them and what you do with the blood. Just to kind of sum this up, we'll begin with verse 29 of this chapter. It says, when the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you. And that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise? You shall not behave thus toward the Lord your God, for every abominable act which the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to nor take away from it. So this is a good way to wrap up the chapter, because just like it began by saying, when you enter the land to dispossess it, you are to destroy all the worship sites of the peoples who live there. So likewise, when you invade the land, never ask yourself, hey, how did the Canaanites worship their gods? Because maybe we can do the same thing. No, absolutely not. Because verse 31 says, everything that they did, every abominable act which God hates, well, that's what they did. That's what their worship consisted of. In fact, they even went so far as to offer their own children, their sons and their daughters, in the fire to their gods. So, I mean, if there's an argument against, in any way, trying to reproduce Canaanite worship in an Israelite context, it's that. Everything that God hates, even to the extent of sacrificing one's own sons and daughters, that's what the Canaanites did. So avoid everything and every place in which they engaged in their worship.
Yeah, if there's one thing that's pretty clear that God is not into as far as worship goes, it's child sacrifice. Over and over again, he has a pretty big issue with this. And it's a weird thing because, you know, we've covered this story, but you have the story of Abraham and Isaac, and so people sometimes think, like, what kind of God is this? Well, there's a lot of things going on. You can go back and listen to that episode. But one of the things that's definitely going on is God is saying, this isn't how we, because it was so common to do that sort of thing, this is one of the reasons why Abraham didn't think it was such an insane request, is because this is, like, because you think, like, well, if God told you to do that, wouldn't you, like, you'd be like, that's not right. No, that's not. This is common practice in the other religions. And one of the things that God is doing is showing him that that's not how he is going to be worshipped, and takes him all the way up to the brink of it, and then says, no, I have deliverance coming in a different way. I have forgiveness coming in a different way.
Yeah, I think the real shocking thing in Genesis 22 is not that God asks Abraham to offer his son as a sacrifice, but that God asks him to offer the son he's waited so long to have as a sacrifice. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just the child sacrifice was common in the ancient world. But because Abraham had waited so long, and because this son was the promised one of God, for God to ask him to sacrifice that son, that's the most shocking aspect of that. And of course, even more shocking is the fact that Abraham doesn't even question. He simply gets up early in the morning, saddles his donkey, and they take off for the place of sacrifice. And in case you're wondering, there is plenty of evidence, archaeological as well as textual, that child sacrifice was practiced in this particular time period. And we have instances besides those we've already talked about in the scriptures themselves. In 2 Kings chapter 3, I believe verse 27, we have an instance where the Israelites were attacking Moab, and the king of Moab, Mesha, was surrounded and outnumbered and was about to lose the battle. And so what does he do? He offers his firstborn son as a sacrifice, as a burnt offering on top of the wall of the city. And it was so shocking to the Israelites that they abandoned the battle, if I remember the story correctly. But I know that King Mesha offered his son as a sacrifice on top of the city walls. We also have evidence from some archaeological not text, but archaeological paintings from Egypt, that in the Canaanite cities, when they were besieged, that they would engage in religious ceremonies on top of the walls and cast their sons and daughters, which presumably had been sacrificed, over the walls of the city. So to us, it sounds horrific, and indeed it is. But it wasn't as if it was unheard of in the ancient world. We have evidence, also archaeological evidence from Carthage, of the Phoenicians, where they would offer children as sacrifices and put them in urns, their bones in urns beneath these inscriptions, which were thanking the gods for answering their prayers. So this idea that you offer the ultimate sacrifice of your child if you're in dire straits was a widespread practice in the ancient world, and that's why God is so explicitly against it in the ancient in these texts, because he wants to make it clear that to the Israelites that no, absolutely not shall you do this.
Yeah, I mean, this is, if you want an additional reason besides like all preserving all of the stuff pointing to Christ, the other reason is he doesn't want them to say, hey, let's explore how worship went down in this area and see if there's anything worth appropriating. Well, child sacrifice went down in this region, and that's one thing that God is completely opposed to them adopting. So for very good reason, God is like, tear all this stuff down, burn it all down. We're not adopting any of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's here, it's elsewhere. Children are a gift of the Lord, and so they are not to be offered up as the sacrifice, no matter what the situation may be. We'll actually get to, when we get to the judges, we'll get to a story which involves an Israelite offering a sacrifice when we get to the story of Jephthah. But by and large, the Israelites avoided this, except when they were in their darkest of periods, when things were just kind of in mayhem and they were practicing, they were actually imitating various forms of idolatry in the ancient world. We do have evidence that the Israelites offered children then, but at least when they were following what God would have them do, they did not do that.
Yeah, and ultimately, I mean, one of the reasons that God is against this sort of thing, besides the fact that it's sin and it's horrible and it's murder, is also that God's plan to redeem his people does involve the death of a son, but not your son or my son or anyone else's son. It's the death of his son. So this is the way that God is setting this up. He doesn't want, he doesn't need the death of a bunch of sons to foreshadow the death of his sons. He's not interested in that foreshadow.
Yeah, and this son will be God himself offering himself willingly as a sacrifice to atone for the sins of the world.
Yeah, and will defeat death in doing so.
Yeah,
I mean, when people object to the death of Christ, I was also like, well, you do know that he knows he's going there to defeat death and rise again, right?
Yeah. This is why he came. This was the explicit reason that
he doesn't stay dead. Like, I mean, easier to die if you know you're not going to stay there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's it, Chad. That is 40 minutes. I think we got through 12. So, you know, some success. One chapter down. We'll be in 13 next week. Guys, if you'd like to support all the things that we're doing over here at the podcast, at Christ Hold Fast, everything else at 1517, you can do so. You can go to any of the sites, go to the donate page, and become a contributor. And we would very much appreciate it if you're one of the people that do that. Thank you very much. Chad, we will see you next week for Deuteronomy 13.
All right. Have a good week.